What up, everybody? Welcome to the second edition of The Tent, the official podcast of the African American Golfers Digest. I'm your host, Michael Williams, and we had our first episode just a few weeks ago, and I want to thank everybody for the outpouring of emotion and gratitude for having this thing. I feel so humbled by the response, how much people appreciated it, how many people said that it was long overdue for this type of content to be available from African American Golfers Digest, and I couldn't agree more. It was a pleasure to do that first episode. My boy Byron Scott showed up, showed out. We had a great show. We had a great time, and I think it's just the first of many. We're going to make this a forum for entertainment and for education. We want to let people know what's happening, you know, what's good, what's funny, what's now, all these things. But we also wanted to leave you a little bit better than you did when you came in. Kind of like the golf course, right? When you go on the golf course, they always say you want to leave it better, in better condition than when you played it. And we want to do the same thing here. We want to leave you in better condition having spent the time with us. So that is our mission. That is our mantra. And hopefully we will live up to it. Today will be no different. We are blessed to have a very special guest by the name of Jimmy James. Jimmy James has written a book called Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Course. This man has played in 1 year the 100 top-ranked golf courses in the United States. And what he learned about golf is important, but what he learned about America and about himself is essential. So he is here to tell his story. I can't wait to get to it. We want to spend as much time with him as possible. So I'm going to be quiet right now. We'll go to a break. And when we come back, we will have the one and only Jimmy James. Again, thank you so much for last week. Thanks again for this week showing up here. And we hope to see you again next week and on and on and on into the future. So relax, get yourself a crunchy snack and a nice beverage, and we'll be right back. Michael Williams, you're in the tent. Get your copy now of the latest edition of African American Golfers Digest in print or digital. It features Alabama's Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail, Chase Johnson's stellar golf season, Gordon Brown Sr.'s big day, Detroit's Cass Tech Girls Making History, Morehouse and Drew Charter School's Bridgestone Golf Day, plus information on events, player resources, and more. Stay informed by visiting our website and subscribing to the magazine at AfricanAmericanGolfersDigest.com. That's AfricanAmericanGolfersDigest.com. Back to the tent. I am your host, Michael Williams, with our new podcast, the African American Golfers Digest. Again, I couldn't be more excited about this opportunity to share the really special things about golf, the really special things about that are attached to golf. And you know, we talk about courses; there are special courses, but I think it's the people, it's the relationships, and the experiences that come through playing this game that we all recognize as that really unique, that really extraordinary factor about golf in particular, as a sport, as a pastime, as a lifestyle, if you will. There are some people, though, who have beyond exceptional experiences. And I'm holding in my hand an advanced copy of a book called Playing from the Rough. This book is, and the subtitle is A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. This book, when it comes out, I mean, if there's an opportunity to get an advanced copy of this, to order in advance so you make sure that you have it right when it comes out, this is what you need to do. Because there are a lot of golf books, and I get a chance to take a look at a lot of golf books. And this one stands out as one of the most exceptional, and I will say even essential reads, not only for a golfer, but for a person of color, and how the American experience is woven through this particular game. It's a fascinating book written by a fascinating person, and I'm very pleased and honored to have him with me here today. Please give, I'm just so welcome to have the author of this book, Jimmy James, with us here in the tent. Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today, sir?
I'm well, Michael. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come on with you and talk about my story, my journey, in the book.
Well, you are most welcome. And as I was saying before we got on the air recorded, we were both recently at Augusta National for the latest edition of the Masters Tournament. And I saw you in the room, and I had known about the book. We got a chance to say hello and shake hands. And it's quite a room. It's a real whirlwind when you're around there, you know, especially at the Golf Writers Association events and that sort of thing. But as I was saying, I wish I'd had a chance to read the book before we met, because you never would have got a chance to talk to anybody else. It would have been just me talking to you about this book. It is an exceptional read. It's an exceptional story. And I just want to start off with it because the story doesn't start with golf. It starts with you and your upbringing. So I just want to start the whole story off at the beginning. To share with us a little bit about where you're from, how you grew up, and actually what you wanted to be when you grew up. What were your aspirations?
I was born in the late Jim Crow era in East Texas, slightly East Texas, north of Houston, there in the Piney Woods, to a single mother, delivered by a midwife, in a house without plumbing or electricity. We were generally, wherever we lived as a kid, not only then, but as I moved through my childhood years, my teenage years, we were generally the poorest family in our neighborhood, wherever that neighborhood was. Even when we lived in the projects during the government housing projects during my senior year, during my freshman through junior year in high school, we were generally the poorest people. So my aspirations started pretty young. I remember at 5 years old setting the very first goal I set in my life, and that was to graduate from high school. I didn't quite understand the plight or what caused us to be like we were and all the people around us. It was, you know, there were those people and there was us. And this was just the way life was. But I knew if I wanted something different from that, I'd probably have to do something that the people around me perhaps didn't do. So I didn't know anyone that had graduated from high school. So I said, I'm going to go through 12 years of school and graduate.
And you sort of intuitively knew that that education was one of the major steps that you could take to change your life, your future, your destiny. And you achieved that and beyond. You graduated from high school and then went on to college, no?
Yes, I attended... ultimately attended an HBCU, Prairie View A&M University, just northwest of Houston, majored in engineering. And that was quite an experience also, because for the first time in my life, I had professional role models, the professors. And they not only taught us the principles, the basic sciences, how to apply the basic sciences to solve problems, but they also taught us what it was like to be a Black professional. And so that was a great experience for me, an eye-opening for me. It was a good way to transition from the world I grew up in to the opportunities that an education would present to me in a world somewhat foreign to me.
And you majored in engineering, I believe, correct?
I did. I majored in civil engineering.
And you went
I
on to a.
started college.
Go
Yeah,
ahead, please.
I'd started college at the University of Houston to major in architecture. And I chose that for one of the silliest reasons, probably some of the silliest reasons, and it was two television shows. There was the Brady Bunch. Mike Brady was an architect, and Wilbur in this show called Mr.
Mr.
Ed,
Ed.
which was about a talking horse, and Wilbur was an architect. So I thought that architecture was math and science, was about designing buildings, and that included the structures and systems that allow buildings to stand. But when I majored in architecture, I realized that the architect was more concerned with form and function, and that the structural systems that buildings rely upon to stand are structural engineers. Those systems are designed by structural engineers, and structural engineering is one of the aspects of civil engineering. So I changed majors from architecture to engineering, and I transferred from the University of Houston to Prairie View A&M University. Prairie View had a slogan back then. It was their 100th anniversary. They were a land grant school dating back to 1876. And the slogan was, Prairie View produces productive people. And I certainly wanted to be a productive person. So and Prairie View at the time, I think, was producing more engineers than any other, more black engineers than any other school in the country. So I went on to get my civil engineering degree from Prairie View, and then on to work for ExxonMobil. For Exxon at the time. We later merged with Mobil, but I spent my entire career with Exxon, climbing the corporate ladder from entry-level engineer to when I retired, I was an executive.
And this is a remarkable, story, a remarkable climb from your beginnings to being one of the top executives and one of the top executives as a person of color in the in an industry that doesn't necessarily have a lot of people of color. So you were maybe it was it your earlier struggles and your ability to overcome that helped you to meet whatever challenges you met professionally in that industry?
Yeah, so I'd say two things. Primarily, the example that my mother set for me and my seven siblings, the determination that she showed, demonstrated her perseverance, her ability to take life as it comes. One of the things I say in Playing from the Rough is that my mother, of course, never played golf, but if she had, she never would have asked for relief or a mulligan, no matter how bad the lie. She would always play the ball as it lies, because that's how she lived. She played the ball as it lies. She didn't complain. She just dealt with whatever came up and found a way to work through it. And that determination, that grit, the idea that when we were abandoned by my stepfather, who came into the picture when I was about 2 to 2 to 3 years old, when we were abandoned by him, we went on welfare for a while, but that didn't sit well with her. She got trained to be a nurse's aide and scrubbed linoleum floors and empty bedpans and to earn a living that she spent mostly on taxi rides back and forth to work. She never learned to drive. There's no public transportation, but it wasn't about changing necessarily our lifestyle at the moment. It was about demonstrating to us that she was responsible for taking care of us, and that we are responsible for taking care of us. And that can do, that grit, that sense of responsibility made a big difference. And so I also say in Playing from the Rough that I don't really have a lot of talents. You know, I wasn't a good enough athlete. I was an average athlete. And Texas has a lot of good athletes. So
Amen.
I was an average athlete.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I was a lot. There's athletics weren't going to be my way out.
Mm-hmm.
The only true gift, I couldn't sing. I couldn't dance. but the only thing that I call my only gift is that I never quit. And I believe the perseverance we got from our mother, the grit, the never give up, the never quit attitude, has just prepared us to deal with the things that are hard. You know, people, when you talk about the game of golf, sometimes people get upset that it's hard. Golf, nobody ever said golf was supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard. And one of the biggest mistakes someone can make playing golf or taking up the game is thinking that it would be easy. I think life is the same way. Life isn't supposed to be easy. It's just life. And so accepting that and then dealing with the things that come our way and appreciating what we have.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking to someone yesterday, Michael, that our worst day in America is a dream day for someone in a country somewhere else.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so that's the other thing I would say that my mother taught us was to appreciate what we have rather than lamenting about the things we didn't.
Yeah, that attitude, that sense of grit and gratitude at the same time, I totally agree, will take you a long way, and very often a lot further than talent. Talent is a tool, but you have to be ready to apply it, to use it. And certainly you had the tools, you developed the attitude through your mother, and I had one of those mothers too, thank goodness, that showed and exemplified what it means to push through and make do and do what you have to do no matter what, just to just keep going, to keep pushing. And so the book is about golf, ultimately. It's about golf, and it's about you and about your life. And as a writer myself, I very much appreciate the way you wove both of those stories in, the idea of how you wove your own personal story and anecdotes about your growing up and your life and your career, and mix those in really seamlessly with the stories of how you played these courses. So when we talk about Playing from the Rough, we have to talk about how you got into golf. How did you get connected into golf? And where did you get the idea to do this book and the idea of playing the top 100 courses in America? And by the way, doing it in 1 year.
So there's a lot to unpack there, but yep. I'll go quickly through it. I took up golf at 45. I was working in Fairfax, Virginia, at our, what at the time was our global headquarters for our downstream business. That's the part of energy where you refine oil and move it around and market it. I got an assignment to run an organization in Beaumont, Texas. And the VP of our division said to me, Jimmy, and it's not his exact words, but something to this effect, Jimmy, you're going back to Texas. You'll get along a whole lot better with the people that you're working with and that are working for you if you start shooting something. He said, you could shoot par, you could shoot animals, or you could shoot par. I don't care which one, but pick one. It was over dinner. My wife was there. My wife picked. She picked golf. She purchased a set of golf clubs for me and some lessons at a place in Beaumont called Games People Play. And so that's how I got into golf. And it was hard. I mean, it's a challenging game. But the first time I actually struck a ball well and watched it, it was one night during a lesson, and it was a dark night, starry sky, and I watched that ball soar over the lights into the stars, and just the feeling of outsized power, the feeling of accomplishment. I was hooked. I was hooked. And so then fast forward, as I was getting ready to retire, I needed something to transition from a 100 mile an hour career jet setting around the globe to a more idled retirement. So I thought, you know, I really used to love driving across the country, stopping in mom and pop stores, visiting people along the way, talking to everybody. And I think what I'll do is travel to all 50 states, play two courses in each state, one with friends, one with strangers. And I'll take the kids with me to the most intriguing places that they've not been to. But before I could do that, my wife had already gotten an invite for me to play Augusta National. And then she followed that up with a book by this guy, John Sabino, who had played the top 100 courses in the world. And so that gave me an idea. I'm going to play 100 courses. I'm going to do it in a year. Why not just play the top ones here in the US? I had no idea what the top ones were. I knew Augusta National was one of them, and I already had an invitation to play there. That I have to attribute to my wife. There's not much that gets in her way. She puts her mind to something too. She gets it done. And she wanted to, me to have the experience of playing Augusta National, so she figured out a way to make it happen for me. And that had nothing to do with playing the top 100. It was just a gift she wanted to give me. But once she did that, she and I decided I was going to play these top courses. I mean, play two courses in each state. She said, "Well, you may as well play some of the best of them." And she got this book by Sabino, and she put some sticky pink sticky tabs on 12 courses that she thought, 11 others besides Augusta National, that she thought either I knew someone or she knew someone that could get me on those courses. That's when I got the idea. You know, why don't I just play the top 100? And 2 months later, Golf Digest comes out with their new list. I say, okay, here's my list. And I didn't have a way of playing. I had Augusta National, that was it. And then I had an idea of 12 more private ones that I could get onto. I'm sorry, 11 more private ones that I could get onto. And then there were 12 resort courses and one public course. And I played at Kiawah, the ocean course, often. And every time I played with strangers, they invited me to come and play their course. So I said, I'll play the resort courses and public courses as a single. And during the idling in between, cheap shots, you know, just idle conversation, I'll mention what I'm doing, and if they're interested, maybe they are a member or no members, maybe they'll offer their help. My goal was to get onto all the courses without ever asking for an invite. And so just to see if America was still that place where grit and determination were rewarded, and where the generosity of others, and their attraction to the dream that someone else could have, their desire to help someone achieve their dream, was still a part of who we are, our national identity. And it was. So I built it as I went. People heard about it, were very happy to help, and I made it through. It wasn't easy, but I did. I made it through all 100. In a year.
And one of the things I was wondering about is just that amount of golf in a year. We're talking about 100 courses in, a little in a year, 300 plus days. How physically taxing was that for you?
It was a grind. It really became a grind. When I got to I remember specifically playing my 34th course, Plainfield Country Club in New Jersey. And I almost made on the sixth hole, which would have put me one third of the way finished. It was a par three, and I came really close to making a hole in one. And so I was elated, and I'm like, and I'm a third of the way finished. And then it hit me. I'm a math guy. A third of the way means you have twice as many left as what you've already done. And so at that moment, my goal really became a burden. I thought about all the travel I had done, all the people I had met, all the work it had taken, and I thought about the fact that I had twice as much of that left. And so it did. It became a grind. And one of the things I'd say to you, Michael, is let's just say a friend said this to me, said, to give you a sense, to give people a sense of that grind, just say to someone, over the next year, I would like you to travel to 100 cities and have a cup of coffee at Starbucks.
Yeah, that's it's a logistical problem. It's a time problem. Could be a budget problem. It presents a lot of
Yes.
problems when you
Yes.
set out something like that.
So something as simple as that. Now say, rather than having a cup of coffee, travel to 100 places and play golf at with 87 of them being private.
Yeah, it's an issue, and it's amazing to me how you again you managed to overcome that through your own force of personality and something that you uncovered about America. And it seems to me that at the same time you were looking to discover the magic of these wonderful golf courses, and I've been fortunate enough to play a number of them that you have played, some of the most famous courses in the world when you're talking about Marion and Shinnecock. Augusta, of course, a number of these,
Pine Valley,
Pine
Cypress
Valley,
Point.
Cypress. I mean, Cypress
Yeah,
is church.
Cypress
You know,
Point.
Cypress is church. It's just an
And
unbelievably
some
beautiful
I'd
place.
never heard of, places like Mayacama,
Yeah.
the Aleutian Club, the Valley Club of Montecito, places I'd never heard of.
And you made these places accessible through your story, through who you were. And I think you uncovered something, not only about these courses, but you uncovered something about America and the times that we live in. That's what I felt when I was reading your writing. You discovered something about America. This is almost an American studies, a social studies book, as much as it is a golf book.
It is. It's a social studies book. It's interacting with all the people in all of the regions of the country. I played golf in every region of the country. And there is more, of course, that binds us, that brings us together, than there is that separates us, that are differences. And when you get down to the core of it, we all focus on the same things, providing a better life for all of the ones that we hold dear to us. And when you really break it down, I think to our core needs and beliefs, the core that are at our core, you find a lot of common humanity. And so for me, whether it was, I mean, it's been a if you look at the arc of my life, it's every phase has been a challenge, but that challenge has been endured because of the generosity of others.
Yeah.
Whether it's when I was a kid, whether it was the teachers who took time to took time with me or looked out for me or created special opportunities, whether it was this like this guy I met that was a veteran that had a shoeshine shop when I was 10 years old, and I went and listened to his stories, and he gave me a shoeshine box. And that shoeshine box allowed me to shine shoes, boots and shoes for a quarter. But those quarters added up, and it helped. It was around the time my stepfather had abandoned us, and so that helped with even put food on the table. It's just the kindness and generosity that I've seen at each stage. So, and then through college, the professors and the job opportunities and the people who help create opportunities. That I saw that same thing on my golf tour as I crisscrossed across the country, as I told people about what I was doing and their excitement about helping, just a commitment to help. And then even this journey of writing a book, the help that I've gotten in terms of introductions to people who could help make it happen. So all of those, that to me is just a part of the arc of my life and my American experience. And that doesn't mean, so one of the things I talk about in the book too, Michael, is that my mother wasn't perfect, but we loved her fiercely. Our country isn't perfect, but that doesn't mean we can't love it, despite the flaws, and then work to overcome those flaws.
Exactly. I
And
mean,
so,
in the documents, in the founding documents, it talks about a more perfect union. It calls on us to recognize the lack of perfection and the responsibility
right.
to take it in that direction.
And then, and what you see, if you actually, as I said earlier, get down to our core, we're all in this together. And working together, we can help make this a more perfect union. And it's going to take time, it's going to take work, it's going to take effort. I tell a story in the book about an incident at ExxonMobil where we're sitting in a room talking about diversity, but there's not much diversity on display. And I, at great risk, stand up and I point that out. At the end of that discussion, some of the folks said, well, we just haven't had blacks in the workplace long enough for them to rise to these levels. And I said, it's not about time, it's about effort. It's work by good people over time that makes progress. And so we, as good people, we have to do the work over time to build that perfect union. We can't look to others to do it. We got to look to ourselves with others and say, how do we do this working together? And so that's been my American experience.
You are
They talk
listening.
about a chain. I mentioned that this idea of a chain, and you're only as strong as a society, you're only as strong as your weakest link. I said that works for a chain pretty well. I know the physics and the physics and the strength of materials and all that. And yeah, that's pretty true for a chain. But we're not a chain. We're a society. We have strengths, we have weaknesses, and working together, we can overcome each other's weaknesses and build something stronger than we can be individually. But that's the America I saw.
You are listening to Jimmy James, the author of Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. This is a spectacular book. I'm Michael Williams, your host here in the tent. Jimmy, you speak so powerfully about the American experience because you've lived quite a powerful story in your own life. So I almost hate to go back to talk about golf, and come down off those larger issues, but I do want to talk a little bit more about the book. The golf parts of it, because you went to some of these golf clubs, and again, I've had a similar experience in terms of the golf world, because I came into golf later in life, advanced very quickly as a journalist, and had an opportunity to play places where you don't normally see, a lot of people of color. And I've had the experience of standing in front of the clubhouse of some of these courses, and like you, I tend to be well dressed when I go to these places. That's just my thing. And I've had the occasion where somebody will hand me a set of keys and say, please, park it in a safe spot, and walk away. I've had a case where somebody will say, "Hey, can you take
There
care of
were
these clubs
places, there
for
were
me?"
some places where I felt uncomfortable in general, just being on pins and needles, being afraid that if I said the wrong thing, brought up the wrong anecdote, story, or something, that word would spread quickly. The world of elite golf is a very small world.
It is.
Elite golf clubs, it's a very small world. And most of the people in the top clubs, they belong to several clubs. They all know each other. And so it was a different world than the one I grew up in, and even a different world than the one I made it to. And so, but eventually, at all the places I played, people made me feel welcome. There was only one place where it was just sort of an odd experience where I didn't talk to a member. And that was at Kinloch in Richmond, Virginia.
I know the place.
But
It's right down the road.
every other place, and I don't think it had anything to do with me, particularly. It was just that was just the culture and nature there. But every place after that, I felt very welcomed, and people seemed to go out of their way to make sure I had a good experience.
That's good to hear, and that's been the case for me as well. 99.9% of the experiences that I have had at some of the most exclusive places in the world have been so positive, and I've always walked away with a new friend for life from one of those places. And as I wrap up with you, I have to say that the book begins sort of talking about your experience at Augusta National and getting the inspiration for doing the 100 top courses in America. But the very next chapter after Augusta, and each one of the chapters is titled after one of the courses that you played, quite
With the exception of
with
one.
the exception of one, which is chapter two, which is entitled
Right.
East Potomac. And you may not know this, but East Potomac and those courses in DC, a special meaning for me, Langston. I was born about a 7 iron away from the back fence of hole number six at Langston, up there on
Ah.
Langston Terrace. That's where I was born, right there in Ivy City in Washington, DC. And as I
Yeah.
say, I didn't come to golf later. My father didn't play golf. Nobody introduced me to golf. We used to play down there at Haynes Point. We used to play ball in the yard, but not even know there was a golf course that was in the middle, 36
Huh.
holes of golf. Never knew it. Later
Right.
in life, after I came back from overseas, I got a job. I was coming out of foreign exchange banking and got a job as the head of marketing and communications and government relations for the concessioner that ran the three golf courses, including East Potomac. East Potomac is where I was birthed into golf. And I really got goosebumps when I saw that amongst all of these noble properties, you had chosen East Potomac as an outlier to talk about and frame your experience. Because I've said places like Augusta are places that have formed American golf as a golf course. It informs, it's like the original DNA for American golf. But the place where you find the genesis of the American golfer, you got to go to East Potomac because that's where you find what golf looks like, the population, what it feels like. You'll have senators playing with cab drivers, playing with lobbyists,
Right.
playing with construction workers, and nobody knows who the other one is and nobody cares. And it's a beautiful thing.
Right.
So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about it, why you chose East Potomac to include amongst all of these other wonderful, sort of noble, highly ranked courses.
So when you look at the book, and this is subtle, but when you go through the book and you see the contrast of my life. I've come from a world that lacked almost everything I write in the book to find myself standing in a world that lacked almost nothing. And that difference between the two, it's just almost too big. The gap is too huge to comprehend. And so that's one of the contrasts, is my life versus the life of that world. Another contrast is the world of golf, what the world of golf was like for African Americans and what it was like for whites. And that's embodied in East Potomac, where those guys came out and played and were trailed by marshals and hecklers and just that contrast. So I thought it only fitting that before I go to all of the rest, I'd already played Augusta, but that's the only one of the 100. And I said, before I play the other 99, it just seemed fitting to experience and that contrast and to talk about that contrast. In the book, it seemed natural. So at the time when I was playing, it just seemed fitting to kickstart the other 99 courses by playing at a place so rich in history, in golf history for African Americans.
And for those who don't
And
know,
then
East
having
Potomac
done that,
being, I just want to fill in some context on this. East Potomac being one of the National Park Service courses in Washington, D.C.,
right.
couldn't be more
And
public.
the first to be integrated.
Yes, absolutely. So much history overall and so much civil rights history has taken place at those courses.
Right.
So just to frame what we're talking about.
And it's in the shadows of all the Washington monuments, even the Lincoln Memorial,
Yes.
where the I Have a Dream speech. And so it just seemed, as I laid out the book and the story, it just seemed fitting to talk about that difference. And I was really great. I was really happy that I had chosen to go and play it before I started to play the other 99 courses. And so that chapter, to me at the beginning, the first chapter sets the scene for what life was like for me. The second chapter sets the scene of what golf was like in America
Yes.
50 years
Yeah.
ago.
Yeah. It's just a very, it's a very effective tool. And I don't know, you're trained as an engineer, but you got a future as a writer, my friend. Don't give up on that one, Jimmy. This is a magnificent book. As I say, on my advanced copy, it says it's coming out in June. That's June 11th, I think it'll be available, and I assume available Amazon, bookstores, all the usual suspects. No?
It can be pre-ordered from Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, bookshop.org. You can, as you're listening, you can go online and pre-order right now.
I love it. Look, this is really a wonderful work. And when you start playing the next 100 on the list, or maybe the next 100 internationally, something at some point, you and I have got to tee it up. I'm not letting too much time pass before that happens. It's an amazing, special work, my friend. I'm proud of what you've done, and can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks for those words. And again, thank you for the opportunity to share my story.
It is thoroughly my pleasure. That's Jimmy James, the author of Playing from the Rough, A Personal Journey Through America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. I will say that, again, our experiences have overlapped both on the golf course in terms of the courses that we have played. I recognize the names, some of the people who he has met and played with. We have a lot of friends in common. And it's that unifying thread that golf creates so effortlessly somehow. And in an age where we struggle to find unifying threads in our culture, I think that when we find one that is this effective, we would be wise to take advantage of it and use it for all that it can be. He's written about how that works, and it sort of serves as as both a guide and just a testimony, really, to the American spirit in so many senses, the American possibility as well. It's not only about where we are and where we have been, but where we have the capability to go through each other. It's a remarkable book. Take a look at it. We're going to take a break. We'll come right back with more. I'm Michael Williams, and you're in the tent. The Tent is also sponsored by Jim Beatty Golf Ventures. Jim Beatty Golf Ventures is proud to present the 4th Annual African American Golf Expo and Forum in Palm Beach County, Florida, August 24th through 27th. The expo is where people of all backgrounds meet to discuss the issues and celebrate the accomplishments of African Americans in the game and business of golf. There will be networking sessions, educational sessions, a golf scramble, exhibits, awards luncheon, and more. The people that make the game will be there, and you should be too. Sign up today to attend at www.aagolfexpo.com. That's www.aagolfexpo.com. Well, that's it, and that's all for this edition of The Tent. I want to thank our very special guest, Jimmy James, with his book, Playing from the Rough. This is going to be a bestseller. You want to go out and get yourself a copy early. Take a look at it so that you can know what people are talking about and be ready to participate in that conversation. He raises important issues about our game that we love and about, you know, our country that we love and the parts of it that we don't love. Let's be honest. He is a thoughtful person. He is a warm person. I think he's a man in full. And I think he'd be wise to go out and partake of the experience that he has presented in Playing from the Rough. Again, go out and get yourself a copy. You won't be sorry. Thank you also for listening. Again, this is our second episode. This is a labor of love. And I do enjoy talking into a microphone about things that interest me, hopefully things that interest you, but to do it on behalf of an organization like the African American Golfers Digest is just a special, humbling pleasure. I appreciate it. I appreciate you listening. Please tell a friend, share the podcast, let us know what you think, and we'll be back next episode with another stellar guest to amuse you, entertain you, educate you, astonish you, and every other kind of emotion we can pluck out of you in about an hour. So be ready. Again, on behalf of the African American Golfers Digest, I thank you. We'll see you next time. In the meantime, go hit some balls, hit them straight. From The Tent, I'm Michael Williams.